revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living in the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have a special guest, someone who I really love interviewing. He's been on the show before, and I think it's a time again for us to get his knowledge and to understand the Constitution. I think if you turn on the news, you're seeing every day some story that involves whether something is constitutional, and there's a lot of heat around this topic, but I'm not sure we really understand it, unfortunately. I don't remember being really well versed in the Constitution when I was taking history in high school. And I'm sure I'm not alone. So this is a very timely interview. We're going to talk with Mr. Paul Engel. He spent more than 20 years studying and teaching about both the Bible and the U.S. Constitution. That experience helps him explain difficult concepts in a way most people can understand. As one manager described, Paul can take the most complex idea and explain it in a way that his grandchild can understand. Freely admitting that he learned more about our Constitution from Schoolhouse Rock, a Saturday morning cartoon, than in 12 years of school, Mr. Engel says that anyone can be a constitutional scholar. He can be heard on American Out Loud Network, and you can reach him on paul@constitutionstudy.com. He's the author of several books, and one that we're going to, I think, delve in today is Read the Constitution in 30 Days. So, Mr. Engel, I want to thank you so much for joining me. I think I'm looking forward to our conversation because it's going to be, I think, an eye-opener for people listening. So thank you.
Oh, thank you for the invitation. I'm glad I could make it. And yeah, I think a lot of people may be surprised. You know, I like to say it's not what you don't know that hurts you. It's what you know that just ain't so that really bites you in the backside.
Very true. It seems like let's delve into current events then. You know, where every time you turn on the TV, you see these district courts overriding what the president has put into play with his executive orders. And I wanted to start with that focus because it's daily, and I'm not sure we're getting the whole story. So as a primer, do the courts have the ability to override an executive order? I guess that's my first question.
Well, the first thing you really have to understand is when they created the three branches of government, they did not create them equal. Almost all the powers of the delegated to the United States are delegated to Congress. A handful are delegated to the president. Really, the only power delegated to the federal judiciary is this, they call it the judicial power of the United States. Well, I like to use Webster's 1828 dictionary, which says the judiciary, the exerciser of the judicial power, they're there to answer controversies. Right? They're there to hear cases and controversies. They don't really have power to do anything. And in fact, in Federalist Papers 78, Alexander Hamilton pointed this out. He said, of the three branches of government, the judicial branch is the least able to injure your rights. They don't have the power. In fact, he says they don't have the power of the purse. He says they have neither force nor will, only judgment. So, and by the way, that they are dependent on the executive arm for the execution of their decisions. So if you think about it, the federal courts really can't do anything. They have wisdom. They're there to decide. They're there to look at cases and make decisions. They ultimately, it's the respect for their decisions that give their decisions power, that where the executive exercises those decisions. And once you begin to understand, part of the problem in my mind is you talk about we don't understand the Constitution. I was actually just reviewing the oral arguments from United States v. CASA, which is the question of these nationwide or universal injunctions. And I can tell you right off the bat, there are several justices that apparently don't know what the Constitution says. I was literally flabbergasted listening to some of their content. And the problem we run into is, since we don't go back to the original source, you know, since judges and attorneys are not taught the Constitution, they're taught what other judges have said about the Constitution. We end up drifting farther and farther away from the original, to the point where the original just seems irrational to some people. And that's kind of where we are now. The idea that you go back to 1803, the case Marbury versus Madison, and people who, by the way, have studied the Constitution, or I should say constitutional law, recognize that as they claim it's the first time the courts assumed the power of judicial review. Well, I made the mistake of actually reading that opinion, and I found a couple things true. One is, while the court does use the term judicial review, they don't use it in the way most courts do today. But the court literally said, even though we think that at this point, the Secretary of State, Mr. Madison, was wrong, the Constitution doesn't give us the authority to order him to do something different. That's the Supreme Court's own decision. Granted, it's a couple hundred years old, but that was their decision, that the Constitution doesn't delegate to the judiciary the ability to write what they call a writ of mandamus, an order to the executive branch telling them to do something.
Wow. So if that's the case, what are we listening to? It seems like they're outside of their scope completely. It's not even questioned, not even a question about that now.
They're well outside of their scope, and they have been for quite a while. And again, part of the problem is, you know, the Constitution starts out with those famous words, "we the people." And I think in large part, we the people have so ignored our government, the government that's created to represent us, it's populated by people we employed, we've ignored what they've done. And as I said, we've drifted far off course. And like, just as a ship at sea, when it's far off course, really has to make drastic direction corrections to get back to where it wants to be, we have drifted well off course to the point where, again, it'd be like playing a baseball game where nobody, including the umpires, know the rule book. And they kind of go from, well, this is how we played it at home. Kind of like, you know, Monopoly. I think it was Parker Brothers that made the game. They commissioned a study. They were getting all these strange questions on their helpline. And what they found is most people don't actually read the rules to Monopoly. They make up house rules. And that's kind of where we are. We're working on house rules rather than the actual supreme law of the land.
Wow. That's kind of a scary place to be when you think about it, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And I think about it every day. And yes, it's very scary.
So my secondary question is the presidential executive orders. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but is this a flurry? Is this more than there's ever been? And what weight do they actually hold?
Well, they've been ramping up over the years as, you know, Congress has moved slower and slower, and Congress is supposed to move slow. They're not supposed to be a react force to deal with an emergency. They're there to be contemplative. We have turned the president into a king. We've started asking him to do things. And in fact, we even embow him with responsibility for things he had nothing to do with. We talk about, was it Clinton had a balanced budget, which, by the way, is factually untrue. But it wasn't Clinton that passed the budget. It was the Congress that passed the budget. It's Congress that spends the money. But we get into this mindset, and what it leaves us with is, again, a really strange situation where we all think we know what is true, but frequently what we think is true is absolutely wrong. And that's part of what, like I said, bites us in the backside.
Well, is there a way back from this? I mean, it's a big question, but is it going to be the people deciding or reading and learning that this has gone well off track and we need to make a correction by voting or making our voices heard? Is that the first step that we can take to claw this power vacuum back?
Yeah, I believe the first thing we have to recognize is it's taken a couple of hundred, probably at least a good 150 years to make this mess. Now, anybody who has large animals, I have horses, I have cows. You take 150 years, you stick a horse in a barn for 150 years, you've got a barn full of stuff. And it takes a long time to clean that out. And that's kind of the way we have to look at this. There is no short-term solution to a problem 150 years in the making. There's not a single election. There's not even a decade. There's not even, a single lifetime that could truly correct everything. But you're right. It starts with, you know, we the people going back to the actual Constitution. You know, our first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, John Jay, said every citizen should read and study the Constitution of his country and teach the rising generation to be free. By knowing their rights, they'll sooner perceive when they are violated and be the better prepared to defend and assert them. So according to Mr. Jay, who, in addition to being our Chief Justice, helped negotiate and sign the Treaty of Paris at the end of the Revolutionary War, wrote several of the Federalist Papers, was Governor of York, he was kind of a busy guy during that time. And he said, the thing we should all do, each and every one of us, is to diligently read and study the Constitution. The expectation, you know what the Constitution says, then when you hire somebody, when you vote for somebody, you're hiring a representative that's going to take an oath to support the Constitution. Well, how do you know if they're actually doing that job if you don't know what the Constitution says? So I believe you're right to saying we go back to reading and studying, realizing we're not fixing the problem in a few years. But like building a skyscraper, you have to start with a solid foundation. And that solid foundation, I believe, is found in the supreme law of the land. The thing that supersedes everything. It supersedes the president. It supersedes an act of Congress. It supersedes the decision of a court. Is that supreme law of the land, the Constitution. And believe it or not, it was written so an 18th century farmer could understand it. Yet too often, 21st century Americans give it little to no consideration. They don't think they're capable of reading and understanding it. And it just really isn't true.
Well, we're ceding our power. We're letting people decide for us. Like you just described at the beginning of the show, it's the interpretation of the original document that's we're living with. And every time we just say to whoever's in Congress or whoever we're voting for that, you know better than I do, I'll just listen to you and I'll depend on you to be my advocate. That's where I think we go off track. And we're going to take a break in a minute, but I want to start off my second question, or I guess my third question now, with it seems to me from what you just described, the Constitution, the structure of the government was very streamlined. It was three branches. I don't think there were lobbyists back in the day. All the things that we're dealing with, oligarchs, people shoving money into the system in order to get a benefit. I want to come back and talk about that, because is that part of the problem that we're experiencing, is that there's a lot of undue influence that takes it away from the average citizen. So let's take our first break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Paul Engel. And I gave a really long question before the break. But my basic question is, all the people who are of influence, whether they're money influence or lobbyists, all these people who have special interests that have the ear of our representatives, in your opinion, was that the way it was at the beginning of the country? Or is this something that, again, grew out of just out of nothing into this massive monster?
Well, I wouldn't say it grew out of nothing, but it certainly, the beginning of the nation was nothing like the behemoth we have now coming out of Washington, D.C. See, you have to understand, when I studied the Constitution, when I really began to understand it, is when I understood three clauses, just three. The first, I've already mentioned, is Article 6, Clause 2. It's the Supremacy Clause. This Constitution and the laws the United States made in pursuance thereof, and treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the laws or constitution of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. It's a little long, but the answer is simple. The supreme law of the land starts with the Constitution. The Constitution of the United States, what it says is the supreme law of the land. Now, when Congress makes a law, if it's following the Constitution, it's also considered the supreme law of the land. If it's not following the Constitution, by the way, not only is it not the Supreme Law of the land, it's null and void. And those aren't my words. Those are Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 78. That's multiple Supreme Court cases that said an unconstitutional act is void. And of course, treaties, well, the United States can only treat with the authority that have been given to it. So that's important to understand that we're not making things up. This is what the law says, the Supreme Law of the land. Then if we remember the 10th Amendment, a lot of people think about the 10th Amendment, the powers not delegated to the United States by this Constitution, nor prohibited by to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Meaning, unless the Constitution specifically tells the United States, you can't do this, they are forbidden from doing it. You hear a lot of people, Obama used to talk about, no. If the Constitution doesn't tell us we can't do it, we can do whatever the Constitution doesn't forbid, but that's not true. This, by the way, is a constitutional professor who can't read the 10th Amendment that says that's not, it works the other way around. We have to positively give the United States a power. And then the third is the Necessary and Proper Clause, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, which says that Congress has the power to make all laws necessary and proper to putting into execution the powers vested in the government of the United States. So we get to see that the Constitution, I've heard it described like a sealed bucket. And every so often, you know, we open the bucket and we put a power in or we take a power out and then we close the bucket. But the United States is only legally allowed to do what's in that bucket. Well, the problem we run into is we've let the United States literally run amok. We've not only opened the bucket, we've dumped the bucket out and said, do whatever you want, generally because, you know, we think we're going to get something from it. I think it was Alexis de Tocqueville that said the United States will continue to exist until Congress figures out it can bribe the people. I'm sorry, it can bribe the public with the public's money. When you look at most of what the federal government does, it is actually prohibited by the Constitution of the United States. I think 90% of the executive agencies do not legally exist because they're exercising powers not delegated to the United States. Over 2/3 of the money spent every year by Congress is on things that are not authorized, the federal government's not authorized to spend money on. That means it's embezzlement. Much of that is used to bribe the states and to bribe the citizens to follow what their whims. Here, we will give you money for this program, but if you don't do what we want, we're going to take the money away. And this whole system has built up centralizing power in the federal government, in Washington, D.C., which, of course, attracts people who are hungry for power. It attracts money, which probably explains why I believe it's the three wealthiest counties in the nation surround Washington, D.C.
I know. I read that as well. I mean, it's really, I don't even have words to say, really, of how maddening this is. That you've got this infrastructure, and I like to digress a little bit, like the executive service, that layer of bureaucracy that nobody votes for. Is that an example of this unconstitutional layer of government that puts a space or another layer between us and our representatives? It's like they are constant. They don't really leave. They have their own agenda, which doesn't fit what people are usually voting for. How did that system actually get set up for those that don't know about it?
Well, again, as bureaucracies grow, they need more layers of management to manage the bureaucracy. To me, the issue is actually a little different. You think about it. So we spent years with COVID and the CDC and the FDA and all sorts of rules and regulations. You realize that neither the CDC nor the FDA legally exist. The legislation that created them was not made pursuant to the Constitution, was therefore an unconstitutional act, null and void. And just think of the billions and trillions of dollars that have been spent just on those two agencies, not to mention the hundreds of others that are exercising powers not delegated to the United States. Now, I understand it can be maddening, but believe it or not, one of the best solutions is to recognize when our founding fathers created this structure, they not only created the federal government, but they created three tiers of government. and they wanted most of the power to exist in the local government. And in fact, I live in Tennessee, and the Tennessee Constitution, along with, I believe, most of the other state constitutions, state that all power is inherent in the people, that we have it naturally. We delegate power to government, but we have it naturally. And when you take that and we begin to focus on what's local, see, the problem is you or I, we cannot fix Washington, D.C. We can't. But what we can do is make our cities and our towns and our counties better. I've been much more engaged in county government lately, especially when I saw my county government trying to do something stupid. One thing that was stupid, one thing that was unconstitutional. And by speaking up, by going to the county commission meetings and the committee meetings and writing for the local news outlet and letting people know what's going on, I was able to impact my county. And I wasn't the only one, right? But I had an impact on my county, which means at this point, both of those resolutions that I think would have been quite damaging, they failed. I've hopefully made my county a little better, a little more constitutionally sound, a little freer than it could have been. Well, if I, as a single person, can have an impact on the county where I live, what about where you live? And think of the hundreds and thousands of people that think like you and I do. That say, this is crazy. This is madness. What can I do? Don't ignore Washington, D.C., but don't focus on Washington, D.C. Focus on your cities, on your towns, on your counties. Make them better. Because if we get enough counties, like I said, I live in Tennessee. Tennessee, I believe, has 100 counties. So as more and more counties, I try to speak wherever I can, as more and more counties hear this and people begin to understand, hey, wait a second, you know, if I study the Constitution, I can look at things better and I can understand things better. And they start hiring people at the county level that actually have a clue what the Constitution says. They're usually the pool of people that end up representing us in the state. And guess what? If we get the states to be constitutional, Washington, D.C. is toothless. It's powerless without the states helping them. It's not completely powerless, but the vast majority of the power, they're dependent on the states to enforce their decisions. And we could make a tremendous difference. But it doesn't start in Washington, D.C. It starts in your local city hall and county courthouse.
I think you make an awesome, excellent point, because it's like it's a carrot and a stick, isn't it? They give, let's say Medicare, or when Obamacare came online, they were going to give the states money to subsidize them. But then the states are on the hook after they took the money, because at some point they were going to claw it back, which they did. And they were jumping through every single hoop to keep the money going, to make sure every mandate was followed. So it's this, I don't know, this greed or this lust for money from the government as if it's free. But you just described how it's kind of a hook. And then the autonomy of the state is gone. So you're saying, and it makes perfect sense to me, that if on a local level we can, you know, divest ourselves from this need to take money from the federal government, hold our local people accountable, get rid of the lobbyists, because they've also descended, haven't they? On the local level, like ALEC, the lobby groups that have inundated the state legislatures, and it's just as bad there in some instances than it is in the government, in the federal side. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, it's the, because they go where the money is. They go where they can buy influence. And governments attract people who want power, who want money. There's an interesting definition. Let me see if this makes sense to you. The offering, giving, receiving, or soliciting of something of value for the purpose of influencing the action of an official in the discharge of his or her public duties or legal duties. What do you think is that's the definition for what word, do you think?
It escapes me right now, but
bribery.
Yes, exactly. It's kind of influence peddling, but yes, bribery.
Bribery.
Yeah.
Which means that the federal government gets most of its power by bribing both the states and the people into doing its will. You see it in the Department of Education. You see it in the Department of Transportation. But, the Department of Education is a bit pet peeve. Tennessee last year was considering no longer accepting federal education dollars, federal money from the Department of Education. I tried to encourage that. It didn't really get very far, but we're going to try again because of the, not just the legal cost that's involved, the monetary cost that's involved, but the moral cost of selling your soul in order to get money. Because once you've got, once they offer you the bribe and they get you hooked on the bribe, it's like a drug, right? It's like the drug dealer. Here, your first hit's free because once I have you hooked, I own you. And that's kind of where we're sitting. And the only way to stop, to my mind, is A, for someone to really realize what is being done. They are accepting bribes. And nobody wants to be considered the acceptor of a bribe. It doesn't look good. But then to realize, okay, if I don't accept the bribe, then what happens? And the legal fiction that it's impossible to run a school system without federal money. That's just not true. It's done every day today, and it was done that way for 100 years. We have to begin to realize that all these programs, all these costs, all these things that the states are fiscally insolvent over weren't actually created by the states. They were created by the federal government and then imposed on the states under the theory of whatever Congress passes, you must do, which is flatly false.
It's funny, too, if you would look at all the money that's supposedly showered on the states, the outcome is worse. These children aren't learning anything. Their ability to think but for themselves and to be independent individuals is pretty much gone based on the curricula of the education system. So I guess a thinking person would have to ask themselves, who's getting the money? It's not going to the children. It's not going to the school districts in a way that's helpful for the kids. So it sounds like this layer is like a vacuum and a little bit trickles out to the kids, but it's never enough because they're never satisfied. Right.
And I think the problem is judging the value of an education system by how much money it spends is really it's a false analysis. The United States spends more money per pupil than any other industrialized nation in the world, but we have some of the worst education outcomes. And interestingly, we used to be near the top in education until 78 or 79, when all of a sudden the U.S. Department of Education was created. Ever since, our test scores compared to the rest of the world have gone down while the money we spend per student goes up. It's not the money, it's what you're getting for that money and the quality of the education. And we just assumed, throw money at it. And if we just throw money at it, everything will go away, because that's really the only thing government can do is throw money at it. They can try to regulate, but it's just easier to throw money at a problem and say, you see, I fixed it. I threw money at it, even though it got worse.
Wow. On that note, let's take our second break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Paul Engel. You can reach him at paul@constitutionalstudy.com. And what time does your show run on the America Out Loud network?
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's constitutionstudy.com.
Oh, sorry.
The radio program is on America Out Loud Talk Radio, 4 p.m. Eastern time every weekday.
Great. Now, I mean, it's what you're saying seems to be, it's common sense. It's just awful that it's gotten to this point. Is there anything aside from what we just discussed that people can hold their people that they voted for accountable? I know it's very difficult, and I can say personally, I tried to see my congressman. I made an appointment months in advance, left my job, went up there, and he was seeing somebody from Brazil and never took the appointment. So I knew how much power I held, in their mind. Voting doesn't matter from that standpoint. And this is the other thing that we always hear. If you vote for something, you'll get a change. What's your take on that? Is our voting system, and it's a big question and you can answer any way you like, but is it worth it? I mean, there's people getting so disillusioned with voting because it doesn't yield what they think it's supposed to.
Yes, it's worth it. But we also have to recognize that we're way beyond behind the curve. One of the biggest problems with the elections, with any election, is the political parties have really taken over the elections at the state level. For example, a lot of people talk about primaries. Do you know what a primary is? A primary is a publicly funded election for a private organization designed to limit who you get to vote for in the general election. Let me say that again, because there's something important. It is a publicly funded, your taxpayer dollars pay for primaries. It is for a private organization. Political parties are not part of the government. They are privately run corporations. They're 501c4s, I believe. Right? So they're privately run organizations. But you're paying, imagine paying for election for the NFL or the NAACP or for the NRA. That's literally what happens here in this country. And that what you get from that vote is less choice. Remember, two of the last three elections, the leading candidate in the Democratic primary for president was Bernie Sanders. In 2016 and 2020, the party manipulated him off the ballot. So you could have written in Bernie Sanders, but the rules for write-ins are very convoluted and very, very tricky. But you have the political party said, no, we don't want you to vote for that guy. We want you to vote for this lady or for this guy. Mm-hmm. And they manipulate the process. And that in large part is because of state election laws. This actually isn't a federal issue. This is a state issue. And, that puts a lot of control. It makes it very hard for other ideas to come forward because unless you are part of a political party or unless you can come up with thousands and thousands of signatures, you cannot get your name on the ballot because of the way the laws are written. So, I think one of the things we need to do is, you know what? Like I said, Washington, D.C. is extremely difficult to manipulate. However, your local and state governments aren't. Now, everybody has different people. And where I live, granted, I live in rural Tennessee, Middle Tennessee. Not only do I bump into my county legislators and county officials regularly, my state rep is frequently. There's a group of us that get together Thursday mornings for breakfast. He's not part of our group, but he's in the same location. He's in the same place, meeting with other people, meaning I can pull him aside and talk to him. If I send him an email, he answers. I have an input. I have an influence, and I can make a change. And again, the states are really – the role of the state really is to be a bulwark against an out-of-control federal government. And, imagine what happens when the states start saying, look at what you're doing. We need to remember the states created the federal government, not the other way around. The states are not subservient to the federal government. They are its master. Just as we are masters of the state governments are masters of the federal government. So once the states realize that they tell the federal government what to do, not the other way around, that influence becomes extremely powerful. And like I said, it starts at the local level because that's where we have the most influence. And it's kind of a great place to cut your teeth to get, how do I do this? How do I communicate with my elected representative, my employee in government? It's a great place to cut your teeth is in your local government, which then helps you when you're dealing with your state government, which then helps you when you're dealing with your federal representative.
Well, I just have to ask, is there any example of the states, showing if they're the master of the government? I can't think of any offhand. Is there some?
Oh, there are plenty. So you do realize that the possession of marijuana is a federal crime, even though several states have legalized it.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
You have several states that have said, you know what? The federal government, they ignore federal immigration law, which, by the way, the power to regulate immigration is not a power delegated to the federal government. So they simply say, no, we're going to ignore that. We're not going to help you. You have the similar things with Second Amendment sanctuaries. And in fact, there was a Supreme Court case, Prinz versus United States, where the court said, listen, the federal government cannot order a state or local official to do anything. They don't have the power to order them. That's why they have to use the bribes. So it's there. It's not talked about very much, but it is there. And it's important to understand that how do you take somebody in a state office and convince them that it's a good thing to stop taking the federal dollars for these programs, that they can, and that's a good thing. That's where the practice comes in of learning it at the lower levels.
So I guess the question I would naturally arise is the people or the states during this whole immigration crisis who were doing sanctuary cities, then that sounds that they had the right to do that because the state can do what it wants, even if it goes against, quote, federal regulations.
Well, I would say they certainly have the argument to say, since immigration is not a power delegated to the United States under the Supremacy Clause, they have no power to tell us what to do. Congress does not have the power to write laws. Therefore, we can regulate our own immigration. The problem is I haven't heard anybody actually argue that. They simply argue that the immigration laws are mean and evil and we have to say no. Would they, you know, that the argument of, sorry, federal government, we didn't delegate to you that power. We didn't loan you that power. We didn't tell Congress, we didn't vest in the United States the power to regulate immigration. So we don't have to pay attention to what you say. I would love to hear a state say that, but it doesn't happen. Now, should immigration be a federal? Should we have a uniform immigration set of laws? Probably. But the point is, until we delegate to the United States that power through amending the Constitution, then the power they're exercising is illegal. And when we divest it via the Constitution, we could set limits and boundaries on it. Right now, we treat it as if it's unbounded because there is no legal boundary. They're simply breaking the law. But if we turn around and say, okay, yes, Congress can establish uniform rules for naturalization. They can institute rules for immigration. And here are some limitations we want to put on it. Mm-hmm. Right. And we, the people through our states, could do that. We don't even know that it's something we need to do at this point because so few of us know what the Constitution actually says.
Kind of a catch-22. But it's interesting that all the states that have put forth these sanctuary types of policies, they're getting the money to run them from the government. Right. So when that money dried up, all of a sudden they couldn't run their little fiefdoms and it stopped. So it's so intertwined and commingled. It's confusing almost because you're not exactly sure where the boundaries lie on your autonomy as a state because you're taking so much money. How do you have, you really can't say very much, can you?
Well, you can. The problem is we don't want to pay the price. We want the money. We don't want the regulations. And there's no such thing as a free lunch. You know, if you think about it, I've seen plenty of people say, well, you know, if we got rid of this federal regulation, we'd save trillions of dollars in tax money. No, we wouldn't, because we'd simply, in most cases, we would move that burden to the states. Take education, right? However much money you get from the federal government, unless you're going to change how you run schools, the state is going to have to pick up that slack. And where are they going to get the money to pick up that slack? From taxes. So it's not a question of tax savings. It's a question of where are the regulations coming from? Because you want them closest to the people as possible, because they are the most, that's where they're most accountable. Sadly, a lot of school boards have shown they're not as accountable as they should be, but in large part, that's because the people have hired school board members that don't listen to them.
Yeah, I've seen that. Definitely seen that. And you know, what's the choice that a parent has then if schooling your child is mandatory, but you're not happy with the way the direction of the education system is going, what's the recourse that a parent could have? It's going back to the local level?
Well, there's several things. And everybody's in a unique situation. So not everybody can do everything. And the wonderful thing about freedom is you get to choose how far you will go. For example, my wife and I, we homeschooled our daughter. The only time she was in a public school was to take the state mandated test. And we actually took extra tests just to show them how well my our daughter was educated without having to go to school. That was a choice we made. We were able to do that because of choices we had made, both financial and the way, you know, and the fact that my wife did not have to work meant she had time to do this. And we ended up with an extremely bright and well-rounded individual for our daughter. But not everybody can do that. People can't afford, not everybody can afford a private school. Of course, we came up with charter schools. That was an interesting idea. They're still publicly funded, but they're privately run. There are a lot of different options. I'd love to see more states enact forms of education savings accounts and other processes that where people can donate to organizations that would provide scholarships for K through 12 education for those who can't afford it themselves. There are, and I'm sure there are dozens of other ways we could do this. The thing we have to remember at the core of all of this is the responsibility to educate a child does not belong with the state. It belongs with the parent. It's not simply the right to educate. It is their duty as a parent to prepare our children for adulthood. And the schools are supposed to help us. And if the school isn't helping you, well, then it's time to, for your child's own good, to get them out of there. How we go about doing that may be tricky and it may involve sacrifice. But as we think about it, this is the rising generation. This is the future. Is it not incumbent on us to invest time and effort and money and whatever into making sure that there's a saying I've heard, right? Be nice to your kids, they pick your nursing home. Well, kind of the same way, don't we want to invest in our children because they are going to be running the country we retire in? And we kind of want that to be a good situation. And what I found interesting is, you know, yes, my wife and I spend extra money on textbooks to homeschool. But because we homeschooled, because we didn't buy into the government education system, my daughter ended up not going to a traditional college university. My daughter wanted to work with horses. She went to an equine school. She got her certification in 18 months, not 4 years. She spent a lot less money getting the education that she can use than the other system that drives people into colleges, where I think only about 1 in 4 graduates actually gets in a job related to their degree.
That's all?
That's the last number I heard.
Oh my gosh.
And you think about it, you're spending tens and thousands of dollars. Many of them are going into debt to get a degree in something that's not actually informing their job. So there's no financial benefit to that degree.
That's a waste of time and money, honestly.
It is, but it's not, you know, I'm from a generation that said, everybody goes to college. If you don't go to college, you're never going to make anything yourself. Well, I had 1 year of college because I could only take that much nonsense. My BS tank was full. Yet I had a 30-year career in IT, very successful. I did a lot of things. I learned a lot of stuff, was financially compensated very well, so that when I decided to just change careers and become a constitutional scholar, I had the wherewithal to do that. But a lot of that came from decisions I made, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago that would allow me, both in my education and my finances, to do what I thought was best. And of course, not everybody's going to agree with me. Not everybody may be able to finance it. But I think we need to be willing to invest more into our children and not simply sit back and be like Ebenezer Scrooge, right? Are there, you know, you say, are there no prisons? Are there no workhouses? My taxes pay for those things. That must be enough. Well, could do we say the same thing today? Are there no public schools? Are there no, you know, high schools? Are there no elementary schools? My taxes pay for those. Those must be enough. Is that really what we're willing to say about our children?
I hope not. And I hope that this is a wake-up call. Maybe the dissolution of the Department of Education might get people thinking in a different manner, that there's not, like you just described, not one way to do things, not one path to success. And everybody's different. So to try to force people into this chute, and some of them just don't, it's not for them. I wonder if that's one of the reasons we're seeing so much anxiety, depression, all these mental challenges that people are experiencing, instead of being able to thrive and be valuable for what you offer, what your natural gifts are. It's your a value's put on you, or you are put into a system that either you fit or you don't, and there's no option. That's, to me, that's the worst thing ever.
You know, I heard a rabbi describe this once. He says, you know, in the Old Testament, in the Jewish scriptures, when they built an altar, they would not use a tool on the stones. You had to use the stones as you found them. Well, when you get to the Tower of Babel, it was all made of bricks. We all know about Egypt and the bricks, but think of the Tower of Babel and the bricks, where they formed these bricks to all be uniform. And there's a couple of interesting things. One is, you talk about it, if you are a stone and you're building a wall, I grew up in upstate New York. We had dry stone walls everywhere, where you had to find the stone that would fit in that spot right to give it structure. You made the wall fit the stones, as opposed to bricks, where you make the bricks fit the wall. And if you have to knock parts off of them or trim them here, well, that's exactly what you did. That's kind of what you're describing, right? Where instead of taking this unique stone, which has its own skills and capabilities and predilections, and finding a spot for it in the education system, we simply whack it off, make it a rectangle, and stick it on a bed of mortar and say, there, stay. That's who you are. And yeah, that is, I believe that is crushing to a lot of souls.
Absolutely. Let's take a short last break and come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Paul Engel. You know, life it can be the most exciting thing because it's a growth experience. What you're describing to me is people being able to grow, to be adults, to make their decisions, good or bad. If you make a wrong choice, then you learn from it. But when you're ceding all your power to the government or some structure, organization that just wants you to go along and just be a cog, then that's not a recipe for a society to thrive. It's not a recipe for an individual to thrive. And what strikes me about the Constitution is that it's the template that allows you to grow, but based on something that's real. That's something that is of value, which is your individuality, your humanity. And people should want that, shouldn't they? They shouldn't just want to have less and like it. They should want to thrive. And this is the structure that we all need to know so that we know that we have options. You can't tell me that I'm limited in this capacity, that God put me on this earth. I have value based on being a human being, and therefore I want to make my own choices. Is that a mindset that you think that people, if they adopted that, would allow them to have much more, you know, options, opinions, and be participants in their, you know, their life on this earth and in this United States?
Absolutely. I mean, go back to the Declaration of Independence. One of the most famous lines from this document is that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. So if you think about it, as a creation of God, you have certain unalienable, they cannot be taken away. Now, life we know, but think about liberty. I mean, I could give you a long definition of liberty. Liberty is living your life how you see fit without unnecessary external influence. That's what you're describing. I want to live the way I want to live. If I want to live in a city, I live in a city. If I want to live in a town, if I want to live in a suburb, I do. I get to choose. Now, I may have to work to get to that end. That's the pursuit of happiness. But of being able to pursue what you want happy. And the purpose of government is not to tell you how to live your life. It's to secure your rights, including your right to life, your right to liberty, and the right to pursue happiness. You know, you talk about the Fifth Amendment and the Due Process Clause. Actually, Fifth and 14th Amendments Due Process Clauses. You cannot be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, a process designed to protect the legal rights of the individual. That's what the structure was. That was the idea behind the Bill of Rights, was not to figure out, well, what do you need to do? It's like, no, what do you have a right to do? And when you talk about selling your decision-making and handing it over, you really talk about enslaving yourself, taking away your ability to decide. Now, what I found amazing, I lived most of my life like most people, right? I got up, I went to work, spent time with family, and I didn't really think about the Constitution. Once I started studying the Constitution, I started learning about what it actually says and the rights it defends and how it defends them. It literally changed my mindset to the point where I realized I don't have to submit. I can live free. And I'll give you a bit of a short example. I was subpoenaed to testify in a federal case. I was subpoenaed by an Arizona U.S. attorney to testify in a case. So I called up, and this is like 2022, I think. So I call up the U.S. attorney's office, and I talk to a paralegal, and yes, here's what's going to happen, and here's this, and here's that. And I said, well, fine, but oh, by the way, I'm not taking the jab. I'm not taking the test. I will only wear a mask under duress, and I will not be silent about it. Now, this seems very interesting, but think about it. I'm not waiting. I'm not asking the government what I will be allowed to do. I'm telling this government official, these are the rules. These are my rules. I have the right to be at liberty. And if you're going to infringe on that right, well, you can only infringe so far before I start pushing back. I wasn't being mean. I wasn't being cruel. But interestingly enough, suddenly the U.S. Attorney's Office didn't want me testifying anymore. It's that standing up. It's the recognizing of your rights and standing up. And, you know, like I was talking about down here in the county, one of the resolutions blatantly violated the 14th Amendment. I mean, not even blatant. Now, towns across the country do this, but this is my county. This is where I live. So as they were considering this resolution, I stood up at least two or three times and warned them, this is a blatant violation of the Constitution. This not only will open you up to lawsuits, but it will open you up to federal criminal charges. Now, there's something interesting when you look somebody in the eye and say, sure, you could be sued and, you know, the county could be sued and they have insurance to pay for all that. No, I'm talking about a criminal charge against an individual for doing this. And it changes the way people live. It's an amazing thing to live free. But that freedom, if it's not based on actual facts and data and evidence, leads to a lot of some of the crazy stuff I hear, you know, conspiracy theories and all this stuff. And, you know, when it's based in the law, when I can point to a legal document, I can point to the Constitution or a federal law and say, oh yeah, here it is. These are the words. This is the law. There's a lot more weight to it. It's given a lot more power and the ability to live free and to be able to stand up and defend that freedom. And recognizing that, you know what, if I have to, maybe I end up in a legal conflict. Maybe I end up arrested. I end up spending a night in jail. Maybe I go to court. But I'm doing that because my right to live free and to protect the rights of my family is worth it. And that is, to me, it's become a very amazing place to live. And I owe it all back to that first start when I decided sat down and finally decided to read the Constitution and the path that that set me on.
Wow, that is a powerful testimony. And it's one that everybody can do, right? It's not like it's you were special. You sat down, you took the time to know what your rights are and to understand them. That's just a great, great story. And I hope people go and get your books and read them, because this is our power now. We have to take it back. We can't depend on others to help us. And you are in a state now where but imagine you don't have anxiety or fear because you have truth on your side.
You're right. I don't have anxiety. I have the truth and I'm willing to defend it. Thankfully, I'm in a place where I don't have to defend it very often. Most people think the way that I do, but you're right. You know, I trace it back. Anybody can read the Constitution. I believe anybody can understand the Constitution. You know, a constitutional scholar is not an expert. They're a student. They're taking the time and effort to learn about it. But one of the things, the skills I have is the way my mind works of taking this information, breaking it down and synthesizing it so that a 21st century person can comprehend not only what it says, but how do I use it? And that's what I've tried to do in my books is give people tools that they can use to better understand and better defend their rights. And one of the things I have on my website, constitutionstudy.com, there's a whole section on questions. You can ask a question. If it's a constitutionally based question, I'll answer it. I do it individually. I do it on the radio, but I don't see a lot of places that are open and say, if you have a question, please ask. I would rather people ask because I love answering questions and maybe send them down a journey of discovery because that they wouldn't have gone down if they hadn't taken the time to say, well, Paul, what do you think about this?
Oh, that's a great resource. You know, time goes way too fast. Can please tell us how they can reach you, your website, how we can buy your books, and how we can empower ourselves like you have.
Well, the best place to follow everything we're doing here is the website constitutionstudy.com. That's where I've got my articles, my videos. There are links to the radio program. If you want to go directly to the radio program, that's americaoutloud.news. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Locals. I'm on a couple of other. I'm on YouTube and I'm on Rumble. I'm not on Facebook because they kicked me off for actually teaching the law about the electing of a president. That was a lot of fun. And I try to speak wherever I can because there's something about that energy of being involved with people. But it's if you have a question, if you have an idea, the best place to go, again, constitutionstudy.com. You can ask a question, sign up for a mailing list, read my articles, watch my videos. You can even follow the news items that I find interesting. I have a whole section of just, here's news articles I think people may be interested in. And that's the best place to go. You can also find my books on Amazon or pretty much anywhere books are sold. You can order them. Probably two of the most interesting is Read the Constitution in 30 Days, a daily devotional for reading the Constitution. I can't tell you how many times people said, well, you know, I'd like to read the Constitution, but I don't have the time. So I turned it into a 30-day devotion. 2 minutes a day, in 30 days, you've read the Declaration of Independence and Constitution.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then my big book, The Constitution Study, this is my clause-by-clause study of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, written down in everyday English so that people can read it, understand it, and hopefully use it to encourage them to learn how to live free, to defend and assert their rights for themselves.
Mr. Engel, thank you so much for joining me today. It was a pleasure and I'm empowered. I'm going to get your book and read it so I can be free just like you are.
Well, it was a lot of fun. Thank you for the time. I always enjoy, you may find I get passionate about this stuff. So I always enjoy the opportunity to talk about the Constitution and how people can use it to live free.
That's wonderful. Thank you again for joining me. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.